Unified with Momobo Ogoro. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome back to Unified. This is the show where we listen, learn and laugh to unify across our differences. We meet people from different and diverse backgrounds across Ireland to hear their stories and perspectives. My name is Momobo Ogoro, your host, and you can get in touch with Unified by emailing unified@newstalk.com. That's Unified with a Y-O-U. Coming up on today's show, our panel will discuss learning alongside prisoners and challenging long-held stigma associated with going through the criminal justice system. We'll talk about how important it is to have neurodiverse characters in books and why young readers need to see themselves reflected in the stories they read. And we meet the Hope and Courage Collective, who want to challenge disinformation and support communities in building a more inclusive democracy. But first, what happens when university students and prison learners learn side by side in the same classroom? Well, a groundbreaking new All-Ireland initiative is trying to answer that very question and challenge long-held beliefs and stigma around prison education and second chances in the process. Ireland's first prison education toolkit has just been launched by UCC, Queen's University Belfast, Cork Prison and Hyde Bank Wood Secure College, aiming to open more pathways into higher education. So joining me today is Dr. Katarina Sfirak, Senior Lecturer in Criminology at UCC, and Damien Quinn, founder of Sperenua. Welcome to you both. So now I know we're talking about education and a really new profound toolkit that has been created to support the rehabilitation of those who are coming out of the criminal justice system. Dr. Katarina, can you explain to us what the North South Together toolkit is and why was it needed?
Yeah, good question. You have to stop me there because I could talk for an hour just about the toolkit and why I think it's important. The idea of the toolkit is basically to encourage other universities, institutes of technology in Ireland to set up similar initiatives like ours. So the toolkit is based on two classrooms, one in University College Cork that we are running with the Cork Education, a prison education unit in Cork Prison, and Queen's University Belfast, who are running their classroom, a similar classroom with in Hyde Bank Prison. It's young offenders and women's prison up in the north. And basically what both of our classrooms are doing, they're called Inside Out or Learning Together classrooms. They're quite unique in the sense that they bring outside students, so these are college students, into the prison education classroom to learn side by side with imprisoned students. And by doing that, we sort of really create a very unique learning atmosphere that really creates opportunities to build community across these two groups of learners that would usually not meet. And both of our classrooms were the first ones in the Republic and in the North, respectively, to do something like that. And we just took the opportunity of some generous research funding we got from the Higher Education Authority to really document what's going on in these classrooms and to share the knowledge with the hope that we can sort of spread the word, spread the message that more classrooms like this will be started on the island.
That's really innovative in terms of this sort of classroom and education-based learning approach. Damien, why do you believe this kind of education is needed between, let's say, students and those who are coming out of the criminal justice system or still in it, matter of fact?
Well, it's a great initiative, and fair play to UCC and Belfast University. I've been following it, and it's been really, really impressive. But it's always been one of my critiques, you know, that there is no continuity. So when you're learning in prison, that learning doesn't generally transfer into the community. So the fact that people in prison are getting to meet with people in the community that are learning similar topics, I think it's really, really beneficial. And it actually helps to bridge the gap and to create continuity from inside to out. So yeah, it's really, really positive work.
Dr. Katarina, can you explain to us how exactly the classroom dynamics work? What goes on? What is the outcome? How do they actually, and this is coming from me from a social psychological perspective, how do they actually, the students engage, all students engage in this sort of dynamic?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's at the beginning of the class, so we do this for the duration of a semester, so that's usually 12 weeks in Ireland. with a bit of a break, sometimes midterm break or Easter break. And the first week is really getting to know each other. And why I'm saying that is because nerves are really high on both sides. So, you know, inside students very often haven't been in a college classroom before. A lot of them would have left education early, although sometimes we do get students who have done higher education outside prison or through the open university in when they're inside. But on average, I would say, you know, meeting college students and being in a third level education classroom is very new for most of them. So they're nervous. They don't know what to expect. They're worried about outside students judging them, you know, for being inside prison. So there's nerves from their side. And then outside students are also quite nervous because usually they wouldn't have been to a prison before. And like all of us, they've been conditioned with hearing about all the stereotypes and the negative stories about, you know, who is behind prison bars and so on. So when they first come together in the first session, we do a lot of icebreakers, getting to know each other, discussing in general what our educational experiences in life have been. And the ice is really very quickly broken. And there's a lot of laughter in the classroom, a sense of relief, and a real sort of desire as students to meet each other as equals and talk to each other like they would in any other setting. And so, yeah, the nervousness, the tension sort of quickly dissipates. And both inside and outside students really, like, the one wish they always have is that the classes go on longer because time just flies. And then as we move throughout the weeks, we sort of go through more content. So you can very much imagine it like a college classroom, but a sort of seminar style. So we are all sitting in a circle, inside and outside students next to each other, and we discuss readings. We do sort of small group work exercises where we discuss certain ideas really in depth. So we do that for several weeks. And for the last few weeks, students engage in sort of creative group work where they're really becoming sort of creative agents of communicating their learning to a sort of bigger audience. And that's where a lot of sort of creative work happens. But yes, the classroom is extremely interactional. We always say it's very convivial. And, you know, a space where there's no fear of the other, no fear of learning, no fear of making mistakes. This is really where the best type of learning takes place. And a lot of prejudices are sort of really removed as well. And yeah, everyone is sad when it comes to an end after the 12 weeks.
This project sounds like a fantastic investigation of just like my own like work and research is around intergroup engagement and how we could actually get different communities, different mindsets, different experiences to come together and really have a shared outcome. And that outcome is this sort of educational achievement, which is fantastic to see. And Damien, from your perspective, why is education so important when it comes to rehabilitation and reintegration of those coming out of the criminal justice system?
Well, for me, like, education is important full stop. Like, I'm a big advocate for lifelong learning, and I try and learn something new every day. But if I was to give a good example of how education and lived experience of the justice system comes together to do something meaningful, myself and my colleague there on the call, we published an article in the Irish Probation Journal about translating lived criminal justice experience into policy innovation. So myself and Katrina wrote that article back in 2023, and it was about creating a new certificate for people with criminal histories. I'm glad to share that it was written into the Criminal Justice Employment Strategy as an action. So that written work that we did together has now formed policy innovation, which is pretty, pretty cool. Like, so that is the power of education. That is the power of academia and lived experience coming together. And publicly here, very grateful to Katrina for approaching me to do that work. It's come to life.
Fantastic. And it's really coming into that sense of not just the lived experience, but that lived experience feeding into education and now feeding into wider strategy to further support those in reintegration and rehabilitation. And it's fantastic to see, specifically as well, when it comes to challenging the public perceptions and stigma around people with criminal convictions and around those who want to actually reintegrate in society. Dr. Katerina, can you let us know a bit how we can actually, through this project and through this kind of toolkit as well for other institutions, how we can lift that public perception around those who have previous convictions?
Yeah, it's tricky. It's the stigma on people around criminal convictions is so stubborn, you know, because it is perpetuated by Netflix series and by sort of popular culture. But I believe that every, you know, we chip away at that stigma one day at a time, you know, and one classroom at a time, and, you know, one initiative at a time, like what Damien does with Spare Noah, what we do with the Inside Out classroom. So I'm very much an educator. So my sort of day job is, you know, working with third level students in criminology. These are students who will go out, they will become probation officers, they will work for third sector voluntary organizations, they will work in all sorts of different support services. Sometimes they'll rise into positions of power, of political power, of other types of power. So really by engaging students in initiatives such as Inside Out, but also within all of our critical criminology teaching, to really, you know, question what do we define as crime, who really does the most harm in our societies, really highlighting how, you know, we sort of have a human duty to hope and believe in change, and that people are able to change. And this is nothing sort of, you know, very benevolent or something sort of airy-fairy. There's plenty of evidence out there that people do change, and sort of to just really combine that knowledge and that evidence that is out there with really also creating opportunities for people to see how that change happens, and to keep on platforming how these sort of processes of change do happen. I must say, despite a lot of institutional and system barriers that still exist, but again, that all of us, both in state institutions, the third sector, and university, also try to change, you know. But it's a long process. But I believe every little bit of change counts and will add up to removing stigma.
And like you said, it's a long process, and all the stakeholders, all the people involved in creating this toolkit, it really spoke to the outcome of the work that you're doing in the classroom right now. And Damien, on the point of lived experience, like, why in a project like this, why is that lived experience of those within and have left the criminal justice system so important?
I suppose, like, people that have a lived experience of justice systems can authentically engage. You know, they've been there, done that, wore the T-shirt, and very often they have a huge desire to give back and help other people exit the system too. So it's like anything, the voice of lived experience is very, very important. But I use that term very, very lightly because, like, you know, at the end of the day, saying that you have a lived experience suggests that the experience has ended, when in fact our criminal histories never go away, and very often on our journey through life, they pop up and cause obstacles and that type of thing, you know, and it remains a stigmatizing factor. For me, like, you know, the way I see it is, once a time is served, once somebody has been punished accordingly and all that type of thing, they should be afforded the opportunity to move on and to get the work that they are qualified to get. So that's very much what our work is about, kind of removing the negative labels, removing the stigma, helping people be the people that they are today rather than the people that they used to be. And yeah, look, all of this type of work is only done and only made possible by people that have lived experience and are willing to speak up and to affect systems change.
And that's a fantastic way of putting it as well, and particularly with those who hold criminal convictions. Like you said, Damien, it doesn't end once they've left the prison system. It's an ongoing process, and particularly when it comes to the qualifications and education, getting into the workplace beyond that, there are many difficulties, like you said. And Dr. Katerina, in terms of this, the project that you're working out, Inside Out project, Inside Out Classrooms project, and also the report, can I ask you, for those, the Inside students particularly, is this semester, is this education that they're taking part of, would it effectively lead to progression into universities after release, or is it just an Inside or prison education project that stays where it is?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And you're actually touching on a very sore point there, because we are trying to improve accreditation and exactly improve that connectivity between getting this or graduating from this course and then what happens afterwards, because really is a challenge for universities and for prison education units as well. So in our case of UCC, we've been lucky, or it took us a while, but we have the module now accredited as microcredits. The university overall is moving towards more a continuing education, strong emphasis on adult education, flexible education model. So where the hope is that over the long term, we develop more degrees that where you can, based on your life circumstances, accumulate microcredits that eventually lead to a bigger degree, a diploma, a certificate, a bachelor's degree, and so on and so forth. As of this stage, we have the microcredits. So we started this whole thing in 2019, the Inside Out. And as of 2025, we have microcredits for Inside students. So that is fantastic. But so far, there is no formal continuation structure. But we are looking at sort of combining our microcredits with other microcredits that students are getting, for example, through UCC. In there's one module in addiction counseling they're doing, another one in is a sort of an art history degree. So we are trying to hopefully, scaffold these together into a bigger degree down the line. But again, things do move slowly, but we don't give up.
And I think that's a right approach, and one of many ways that one can actually get the accreditation that they need in order to use their education for potential employment in the future once they are released from prison or released from the circumstances that they were in. And I suppose specifically when it comes to what's next within the program or what's next within the project. Dr. Katarina, I'd love to hear from you. Like, where do you believe that this toolkit can go? Where do you believe that this initiative can go? Will it just remain between the two universities, or where do you want it to go in the future?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question as well. Like, it has already expanded since we finished or while we were writing the toolkit. So my colleagues, my colleague Dr. Gillian McNall from Ulster University and her colleague Marion Doherty are teaching, have set up similar classrooms in Ulster universities through two campuses, the Belfast and the Derry campus. And students there actually do this type of learning for two semesters in a row. So they do a law degree in the first semester, and in the second semester, a criminology degree like our UCC one. So, and that's in addition to Belfast. So it is spreading around. In Ireland, so far, I'm not aware of anyone else taking this up. It really takes initiatives of university lecturers themselves, taking this model and running with it, and prison education units equally. So that would be my hope, that the toolkit will spread the message and just encourage others to do similarly. It's not the toolkit is really a very loose toolkit. It's meant to serve as an inspiration, not as the be-all, end-all sort of blueprint. And in UCC, I'm hoping, and for our local corporation, Cork Prison, I'm really hoping that, or our next hope and plan is that we can expand it into a sort of diploma model, that really affords more accreditation, more continuity for Inside students in particular.
And that's a fantastic roadmap in terms of moving it ahead. And it's great to see that other universities are and lecturers specifically, like you said, are looking to apply this model within their classrooms and apply this in a way that is not only for those inside outside students, but the inside students to proactively engage with education. And Damien, yourself, in terms of that proactive engagement with education, what would be your hopes and dreams for those who have criminal convictions and want to use education as a tool to be proactive in society?
We work on that all the time. Like, we go into the prisons and we do personal development, life skills, motivational speaking and that type of thing in the community. Then we run leadership programs with our colleagues in Belfast, people, this lived experience leadership program. And basically people want to kind of move into positions in like the probation maybe, or the ITS, the Irish Prison Service, So a lot of the education that we are promoting in prison shows pathways into meaningful work, supporting other people leaving justice systems. So yeah, look, in fairness, anywhere we go, like, and anywhere I certainly go, education was very much the key that unlocked a new life for me. And I would always encourage anybody that we connect within our network to tap into some sort of ongoing learning, professional development, whatever it might be, informal or formal. Because, yeah, look, life gets an awful lot easier if we're willing to learn, you know. And I certainly learned a lot going through my own criminal justice journey and beyond. And it stands me in good stead today.
Well, thank you so much, folks. That was Dr. Katarina Svirak from UCC and Damien Quinn from Sperrynua. Up next, we'll be talking about creating neurodiverse characters in books. That's after the break on Unified. Welcome back. You're listening to Unified. So how important is it for young readers to see themselves reflected in the stories they read? And how important is it for them to see neurodiverse characters in books? Our next guest is a Thai-Irish author named Emma Sheva, and her latest young adult novel, My Name is Jodie Jones, has just won a major honour at the KPMG Children's Books Ireland Awards. Emma is joining us now. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, Emma, can you talk to us a bit about your journey as an author and what came as a realisation for you to start writing?
Oh, that's a good question. So I've always written, but I never really liked the way it sounded, and I couldn't work out why the books I liked sounded this way. And when I did writing myself, it wasn't quite right. And I think it takes a while for you to keep writing and you get better. And suddenly, instead of thinking, oh, yeah, I wrote that, you read something, you think, oh, I wrote that. And you feel a bit more kind of confident and proud of yourself. So I think that was a journey in itself. And then I have four children. And my children wanted me to make up stories at night. And I was really tired because four of them is quite a lot. And eventually I started writing something for them. And it would take me a couple of weeks to write something. And then I'd read it to them in the evening. And they would, wow, what happens next? What happens next? Oh, gosh, I have to go and write the next bit. So that kind of got me into writing for children and young people. And I was surrounded by children and their friends. And I thought, I kind of know their world and the things that they're interested in. So I started writing. I had done a master's degree in writing, and I wasn't sure that I wanted to write for children. But after I started writing them stories, I then got into writing for children. And so this was the first one that I've written for teens and young people.
And now the book has actually won the Honor Award for Fiction at this year's KPMG Children's Book Ireland Awards. Can you tell us more about the book, My Name is Jodie Jones?
Yeah, sure. So it was a funny one, actually, because I started it 10 years ago. I had the first three chapters on my laptop and I'd left it for ages. I've got lots of bits on my laptop, and I had another book to write for our middle grade, so for 8 to 12s, and I had have a really busy job. And so I was sort of, I left it there for a while, and then I came back to it and liked it and thought, I'm going to carry on writing this. So the book is about, she is neurodivergent, but I don't state what it is. I've dropped it in near the end and leave it there. So she's a girl who's 15, and she has a difficult mother who's quite pushy academically. She wants her to really achieve a lot, her and her older brother, who's called Champ. She also is disconnecting from school, so she's not doing any schoolwork, and it's really crucial kind of pre-exam year learning, and she's very bright. And so the school's freaking out, her mother's freaking out, she's refusing to do anything except collect words and sentences and repeat the sounds of words in class. And as the book goes on, you realise that there's a reason for this, and it's actually a bit of a coping mechanism for her, because there was an incident in her youth, and she's seeing psychiatrists and psychologists and has been for a few years. So without giving it away, there's a sort of plan that she has, and then there's a big sort of reveal towards the end. But it's kind of about her finding herself, trying to save her family, meeting someone who she's got a love interest in. Yeah, that's the suggest.
That sounds really interesting. And you said it's targeted towards teenagers. Myself, I'm like, let me dabble into it myself and read.
Yeah.
Because I remember I was a huge teen reader myself. But I suppose, like you said, the story was... It is about a character that is neurodiverse. You don't explicitly name it until the end.
Yeah.
But why is it so important to have that sort of representation in storytelling, particularly at that young age?
Yeah, I think it is really important. I mean, I'm a teacher. I work in the learning support department as well as the English department. I work with a lot of children who are autistic, have ADHD. My son has ADHD. We have a lot of ADHD and a little bit of autism, but mostly ADHD in our family. And there's a lot of different kind of undiagnosed divergence. And I think it's really important for people to see themselves in books, but it's also interesting to think of the world through the eyes of someone else. And we do that with literature, and that gives us a way of having more empathy. But it also is a way of seeing, having a different way of thinking. And Jodie Jones has got a really different way of thinking about words, about the world, about things that she sees. Yeah, I think it is really important. I think we live in a world where, when I was growing up, there wasn't very much recognition of neurodivergence. And I think the fact that we now recognise and support people and their different ways of learning is so, so important. It's changed everything. So for children,
it's a huge game changer. Like, and like you said, in terms of just that empathy building and seeing things from people's perspective, like even the role of books as well, in terms of that empathy building piece. What is your opinion on that, particularly for young readers too?
Yeah, I do think it's really vital. I think we live in a much more, I think it's a more fractured world in a way, because we, even though we're more connected with phones and technology, we're also in our rooms or on our screens a lot on our own, connecting in a really different way. And I think that in order to kind of feel like we experience the world of another, because obviously algorithms and things like that make an echo chamber, so everything that you're looking at, is you're going to have reflections of your way of thinking. And it's quite difficult to step into the mind and the viewpoint of someone else. And I think literature is still doing that, and films, but it's really important to be able to see the world from someone else's point of view, and to read it and to read the rhythms of that is different to watching something. I think you're immersed in a different way when you're reading. And I think it's really important, especially for this National Year of Reading, it's really important to have books that people can connect with. They can connect with the characters, they find the book interesting, they are gripped, they can't, you know, you can't put it down. And it's not because it's a thriller, it's not a page-turny crime novel, it's thrilling and gripping in a different way. And I think that's really interesting.
Super interesting, and particularly for young readers. And I know, like, I grew up in a different generation where there wasn't TikTok or there wasn't Instagram and things like that. So, like, picking up a book, picking up a puzzle was like the thing you do. But for today's young readers, do you think it's harder for them to engage with literature, to sit down and have even the patience to have a 100, 200 page novel to read through?
Yeah, and we're seeing that. I mean, publishers quite often are looking for shorter books. Agents are saying shorter the better when you're writing a book. I think quite a lot of books are broken up. So there's the text, and then there's either, like Wimpy Kid, there's some cartoons or some illustrations, or people are laying it out in a different way so it doesn't look like a wall of text. I think definitely and it's not just kids, our concentration has changed. I know lots of adults that say, I used to be able to sit and read books and I find my concentration is all over the place. And even mine, like if I sit to write, it's less so when I'm reading, but if I sit to write, I find myself much more, there's this impulse that to pick up my phone, or there's an impulse to go on a different website, or an impulse to get up and go and do something else. And I've started to notice that little, it's like a little electrical jump, and I'm like, no, you know, I recognize it in myself. I think we are all becoming more distracted and distractible. And one of the things I've been trying to kind of do myself is have a bit more slow time for reading, or and slowing it down so that time feels long again and wide, rather than something that flies by in an instant and you think, gosh, is that at the end of another day, another week, another year, you know, that slowness. And I think reading it's almost like we have to retrain ourselves a little bit to, instead of just reading, I'm going to read a page, or I'm going to read 2 pages, I'm going to sit for 20 minutes or half an hour. And I read this article about retraining yourself to read, and it was kind of going up in time frames like that, you know, sit for 10 minutes, sit for 20 minutes, sit for 40 minutes until you can sit for an hour. And this is for adults. And I thought, wow, that's amazing.
It's really difficult to do,
like where we're at, yeah.
Especially when you're addicted to your phones or addicted to the buzzing. And
yeah,
it's hard to just sit down as an adult, yeah. Let alone a child that has grown up in this sort of technology era that we're in, and specifically forced into specific silos online. So that expansive thinking and that level to slow down, even to think and critically reflect on things, is so important for young people today, and particularly to see it in different mediums such as literature, such as art, such as film. And I want to ask you, do you believe that there is like a growing demand for, let's say, like inclusive neurodiverse storytelling? Do you believe there's a growing demand there for it? I see you have that award, so there's recognition for it. But for wider readers, do you think that there's a growing demand?
Yeah, I think there is. I think it's partly that people's, I think that spectrum of neurodiversity, that sort of within each neurodivergence, but within I think we're only learning now that there's neurotypical is quite, it seems to me, a rarer thing than we thought. I feel that there's lots of different divergence within people, within their learning, and there's things that we're only really picking up on. I know someone at work who was only just diagnosed as autistic last week, and he's an adult. There's people finding out about themselves and making connections of why they're different. And even if you're not, and even if you don't recognise that, I mean, most of us know someone. So I think having that in literature is really important. There's been a dearth of that over the years. And it's important to represent that. But it's also important that one of the things that Jodie Jones has is a really good support network. She has an excellent best friend. She has a dad who's got her back. She's got now Moses, who's her brother's friend, who's her love interest, who's kind of got her back. And to have people that understand you and accept you for who you are, and call people out for being mean to you and step up to try and kind of help you, I think, you know, that's what we need. We need more of that.
And it's so important, especially for young readers who may not have that social network and that system around them for support, to read what that actually can look like or potentially be for their lives as they grow older. And what do you think in terms of that importance for children to kind of see their stories reflected, even if it's from a neurodiverse perspective or other intersectional perspective? How is it important for them to see their stories reflected in literature?
It's crucial. I mean, when I was growing up, I was mixed race. I'm Irish and Thai in South London, and South London did have, I mean, my Irish grandparents, one was from Dublin, one was from Cork, came over to England when my grandfather retired from the Guards, and my mother was 14, and she's one of five, and they came over, and there was a lot of name calling and kind of I don't know, people poking fun at them because their education had been different, their accents were different. It was quite a lot of racism in England at the time, and they found that quite hard. And so when I was growing up, I had sort of their all of their histories, you know, that's kind of, that trauma becomes intergenerational, you know, that feeling of people kind of being prejudiced against you or whatever. And then I'm Thai. I didn't know anyone else who was Thai. And all the books I was reading were, I mean, I didn't really read Famous Five because it was a bunch of five white kids, you know, out in the fields having nice adventures. And it wasn't my world. I was growing up in an inner city with a completely different set of circumstances. And so had there been more books about kids like me, kids without dads, kids who were half this and half that, or kids that were having inner city, it would have been so different for me. And you feel seen, you feel like you're important enough to be in a book. You can read the book and say, oh, I'm like, oh yeah, that's like me, or I feel like that, or oh, and that would have been game changing, and it wasn't around. So you kind of feel like it's a bit of a calling.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Emma, for joining us on the show. And now, coming up after the break, we'll be talking to the Hope and Courage Collective. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to Unified. So as many of you know, conversations around immigration, identity and misinformation is increasingly becoming heated both online and offline in Ireland.
But one organisation says that communities need more than outrage. They need resilience, they need solidarity, and especially hope. The Hope and Courage Collective works across Ireland to counter hate, challenge disinformation, and support communities in building a more inclusive democracy. So joining me now on the social scene is Executive Director of the Hope and Courage Collective, Adele McGinley, to discuss the rise of the far right in Ireland and how communities can come together to combat it. So welcome, Adele, to the show. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. And thanks very much for having me here. It's great to see you again.
Delighted.
Yeah.
Now, the Hope and Courage Collective, what is it and how was it founded?
Yeah, so we're an organisation. We were set up a number of years ago. So we're set up to kind of support communities, workplaces, institutions to respond to hate and disinformation and the rise of the far right in Ireland. And we do this mainly through kind of research, community support, community outreach, community responses, building kind of analysis and sharing that with communities to try and build an understanding of kind of what hate looks like in Ireland in the current context. So yeah, we've been around for the last 3 years, really 5 years, set up as a kind of a project and became an organization in the last few years. So
that's fantastic. Mm. And like, it's especially with the growing rhetoric around misinformation, disinformation in Ireland, it's really important to have initiatives like yourself. And you said something there. You're doing work on what hate looks like in Ireland. Can you tell us, what does hate look like in Ireland right now?
Well, we had a report out just recently, actually. It's called Ireland in Focus 2025. And actually, there's a number of kind of key findings in it, I suppose. But firstly, maybe to preface, before I go into maybe what hate looks like, to kind of say that this report is kind of a good news story. It's a report that kind of shows that the public are ahead of politicians in terms of how we're responding to things. But I suppose in this report, we looked at 2024 and 2025. So we kind of looked at 2024 in comparison to 2025. And I suppose the key findings was that the far right have not secured kind of broad public support, but they are kind of shaping the conversation. And I suppose just kind of to dig into that a bit, you're asking, like, what does hate look like? I suppose what we've seen, like, over the last number of years is kind of a number of groups that are very much targeted by hate. So we've seen kind of ethnic minorities. We've seen last year a very focus on the Indian community, attacks on the Indian community, you know, kind of anti-immigrant mobilisings across the country. We see women who are the subjects of hate, disinformation online, LGBTI community, particularly the trans community. We've seen workers, particularly in IPAS centres, politicians as well, who've been targeted by hate. So there is a broad spectrum of people in the country who've been targeted by hate. But it's important to note that there's a minority. It's quite a minority, and they have an oversized impact because of the role of social media.
Mm, and what is the role of social media in spreading this?
Yeah, so I mean, we all know what social media is. We've been around it for very, very many years. But really, I suppose since kind of 2016, hate has really been amplified through kind of the role of algorithms. And basically what we've seen from 2003 onwards is kind of, you know, a small minority being able to kind of shape the conversation through amplification. So, and we know that hate sells. So the more kind of provocative, the more emotional, the more kind of hateful content that's produced online, the more it gets traction, the more it gets shared, the more it gets visibility. And that visibility looks like it's a majority view when in fact it's not. So that's kind of a context that we're in. And I suppose for many years, we've been, you know, calling for the regulation, better regulation of social media companies and kind of the reining in of the big bosses in terms of, you know, social media companies and turning off the recommender systems that kind of pump hate and vitriol into people's feeds. So we're kind of saying that people, you know, should be allowed to choose what they see in their feeds. I suppose in this, so there's a context in the last couple of years, I suppose, you know, we have seen, you know, a huge amount of attacks on IPAS centres. We have seen, as I said, different communities who are being attacked online and offline as well. But we've also seen a kind of So in the 2024 elections, you know, there wasn't a huge amount of far-right parties, kind of people who are running on hate agendas weren't elected. They were actually routinely rejected by the country. And so what we've seen is a shift in tactics kind of to more kind of on, you know, street patrols, more kind of violent vigilantism. We've seen, you know, kind of, so when people lose ground, we kind of see a more, you know, that people are that things have shifted to a little bit more violent.
And that's kind of like a scary reality, because when you can't get political gain, let's say, that people take ulterior motives. So it goes to the point of why there needs to be a lot more community resilience and a lot more community solidarity and strength. And your work focuses on that. Can you tell us more how you focus on that community resilience and solidarity?
Yeah, maybe I just wanted to first just talk a little bit about kind of the research that we've done over the last couple mm-hmm. of years, and very much kind of linked to public attitudes and sentiment shift. So we carried out research both in 2024 and 2025. Both samples were with 3,000 people, so a very highly representative sample. And really, we wanted to kind of measure two points in time and how people were, what their attitudes were. And actually, year on year, what we have seen is kind of public attitudes become more progressive, not less progressive. And that's in, you know, against a backdrop of, as I said, you know, riots, arson attacks, attacks on immigrants, anti-immigrants, you know, rhetoric, anti-IPAS centres. So what we kind of see with this research is actually the public are shifting to more progressive attitudes. So what we found was that 66% of people agree that immigrants contribute positively to Irish culture and community. And that was up 2% from 64% in 2024. 79% of people believe working class people are struggling due to systemic inequality. That was up 2% from 77% in 2024, already high. 75% support the freedom of transgender people to live their lives. And that was up 5% from 70% in 2024. 69% believe people or believe wealthy people are successful because they're given more opportunities than others, so up 6%. And then 80% agree that Black, Asian and minority ethnic communities face greater barriers to success than white people, so up 5% from 75%. So very significant, you know, shifts, sentiment shifts year on year, and kind of very heartening, I suppose. And actually, this kind of goes to your question, really, because this is what we see in communities. You know, we work with communities all across the country, you know, and we see this on a daily basis in terms of people, you know, standing up in their communities. If there is hate that comes to town, people, you know, are there and ready to kind of counter that. Between 2024 and 2025, we have done 89 community responses. So that means there's been, you know, kind of hate has come to your town, and we've supported a number of local communities to respond to that, like places like Athlone, in Clonmel, in Mayo, in Dublin City, so all across the country, really. And you know, the what we found over the years is that people are sound, are more sound than not sound. That's reassuring. It's also, we've also found, I suppose, that again, a minority of people have an oversized impact because they have a giant megaphone, you know, on social media, and they're shaping the conversation. And that conversation has also kind of shifted political rhetoric to the right. It has shifted policy to the right, particularly around immigration. And I suppose this is kind of what our report shows as a cautionary tale.
And what do you think needs to be done in terms of that gap, in terms of the public sentiment versus the political reality? What do you think needs to be done there?
I think there's a lot to be done at a local level. I do think people need to speak to their politicians and tell them how they feel. I suppose we have to, you know, kind of address the role of social media. We really need political leadership on this. We really need social media, not to be driving our politics. The reality is that you know, communities are welcoming, that people show up for their neighbour, that you know, we all want safe and affordable housing, we want, you know, healthcare when we're sick. These are the types of issues that people care about, and they're the types of issues that we need to be talking about. Cost of living obviously is something that people are concerned about, but ultimately it's like, how do we put food on our tables, how do we heat our homes, how do we, they're the types of conversations I think that we need to be telling our politicians, that like, these are the things that are that we all care about and that we all want, and that's what our community wants.
And it's important for people to really say, use their voice, talk to their politicians and create that space of sharing that, I like to call it the wider we, of this is what we all want, considering the different backgrounds and stuff that we all hold. And particularly when it comes to that misinformation and disinformation online, can you give us a quick tip that people can start to, like say their family member says something that, oh, I saw this on WhatsApp and my friend Mary told me about this and this, but it's complete disinformation. Can you give us a quick tip that what people can do in those situations?
I mean, part of the work we do is kind of about opening up conversation. Unfortunately, we can all be duped online. I have been, others have been. So we do need to kind of check our sources of information. So we do need to be really careful. But it is important not to blame. It's important to open up space for people, you know, to get it wrong sometimes as well, but also to, you know, obviously to try and bring people back as well. But yeah, I suppose in terms of addressing dis and misinformation, and people share things, you know, it's misinformation. Disinformation is, you know, probably a little bit more, might be harder to recognise, but you know, it is important again to check our sources. And I suppose so much, you know, of the information lands in our feeds as well, in terms of, you know, memes and pictures, and something might be fleeting and you see it and everything is top line and top level, and you know, so again we kind of need to dig in a little bit sometimes to what we're being fed in our feeds, and not, you know, believe everything that we that is forced into our feeds, because the algorithm is interested purely in money. It's interested in our attention. Attention is money. So we have to, you know, also understand how the the attention machine is trying to, you know, make money off us.
It's an attention economy, as they say, and it's something that people need to be aware of. Okay, why is this grasping me, or why am I clicking into this? And people need to read beyond the headlines and see the actual information. Well, thank you so much again. That was Adele McGinley, Director of the Hope and Courage Collective. Thank you, Adele. Well, folks, that brings us to the end of today's episode of Unified. Unified is supported by Commissioner Mann. Find us on podcast and the Go Loud app and share your thoughts at unified@newstalk.com. That's Unified with a Y-O-U. Thank you, Marisa Sullivan, for producing, and Aisha Neve on the research. Join us next week for more on Unified, Sundays at 8 p.m. on Newstalk. See you soon.